Let's go live now to CBS military analyst and retired Army Colonel Jeff McCausland. I have a lot to talk to you about this morning, Jeff, but let's start with the CBS News documentary, which caused kind of a stir yesterday. It was called Arming Ukraine, and part of it talked about the supplies, some of the non-military supplies we're sending to Ukraine, and said that it wasn't making it to the front lines, implying that it's either been siphoned off for other purposes or being sold for cold, hard cash. What do you know about this?
Well, there have been allegations of this, and one of the real challenges we've had in the Ukraine, and the Congress has actually started to insist on this, is more oversight on distribution of resources. In essence, it's my understanding from the people who coordinate these efforts that once it gets to the Ukraine and crosses that border, we lose pretty much sight of where this all stuff all goes. And, of course, accountability of major end items like a howitzer or like a vehicle, et cetera, is pretty easy to keep track of because they're all serial numbered. When you talk about individual things like rations or you talk about medical supplies or even ammunition, obviously the accountability of that is very, very difficult. Accountability of that kind of stuff in any wartime environment, very hard to do anytime. Trust me, I've been in several combat zones, but particularly in a place like Ukraine, which obviously, though we support, obviously we think is moving its way in the direction of a democracy, still even prior to this war, got pretty damning marks on being, you know, suspected of large-scale corruption in various parts of its government.
Now, Ukraine pushed back on this report, saying that CBS relied on a source that was trying to make the Ukraine government look bad. Is there any truth to that?
I would think not. I mean, I have great loyalty to CBS, obviously, for the many years I've worked for them. Dave, you know as well as a journalist that I've got respect for the journalists that do those kind of things. Now, doing them under very, very difficult circumstances. And clearly the Ukrainian government has its own desires to maintain a narrative on what's occurring, and that's what they're trying to do. But I'm pretty confident that if CBS put that out there, it had been done in a professional manner in terms of the research and investigations, verified, and they will clearly stand behind the reporting.
And so as far as you know, the at least most of the weapons that we're sending to Ukraine are making it into the field?
They're making it into the field. They're not making it into the field perhaps as rapidly in some cases as the Ukrainians might like. Part of this is just a physical, logistical problem of moving equipment and then moving it across Ukraine, which is still a battle zone and areas are subject to being struck by the Russians from afar. Secondly, of course, there's always the problem of what we call the absorption rate. You know, I can give you a soldier a weapon, a rifle, and teach him how to operate that in a matter of an afternoon. Even a javelin or an anti-tank weapon may take up to maybe a day to make him or her proficient. But if you're talking about sophisticated artillery, fire direction radars, missile systems, et cetera, it's going to take a lot longer period of time to train somebody up. You can't just transfer it over to them and expect it to be effective on the battlefield. And that certainly goes for also the maintaining of equipment. You're talking about vehicles, tanks, et cetera. Not only do you have to provide them the equipment, the training on to operate it, you've got to set up the supply chain that allows repair parts, et cetera, to flow in to keep that particular piece of weaponry on the battlefield.
Now, in terms of how this whole conflict might play out, we're getting reports this morning that in South Ukraine, which is occupied by Russians now, there is a guerrilla resistance going on by Ukrainians loyal to the Kyiv government, where they are basically killing Russian administrative officials, as I understand it, and blowing up Ukraine's own railways. What's the effect of this going to be?
Well, the Ukrainians have been trying to mount a counteroffensive in the south in the direction of Crimea, particularly initially on the city of Kherson, which was occupied in March by Russian forces. And they seem to have had some at least modest success. Obviously, those partisan operations that you're talking about have been going on for some period of time. But that now has a more direct effect because obviously it forces the Russians to move forces away from the front lines to take care of problems in their rear areas. It interrupts the resupply routes that connect Russia proper across the southern portion of the country towards Kherson and towards Crimea, which have been disrupted, and the Russians have had difficulty with the resupply since the war began. So it has that kind of direct effect on this particular offensive. And also it's forced the Russians to redeploy some of their forces from the southeastern portion of the country, the so-called Donbass region, to meet this counter-effectiveness. in those places, the movement of men, materiel, ammunition, et cetera. The Russians depend a lot on those railway networks, so disrupting those railways will have a direct bearing on the Russian ability to resupply.
At the same time, we're hearing about missiles being fired in the vicinity of what is apparently Europe's largest nuclear plant and coming very close to it. So is this, would this be a strategy where they would try to, what, create a or threaten to create a nuclear meltdown unless Ukraine surrenders? I mean, where could that go?
Yeah, that could go in a lot of bad directions. And you're talking about the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant occupied the Russians again early on in the conflict. They have been using this as kind of a base to fire artillery at Ukrainian targets, figuring they were relatively invulnerable that the Ukrainians wouldn't fire back. At the same time, they not only captured the facility, but they basically secured the workers of that facility who've been operating it now for several months. Several of them have escaped. There have been some suggestions of those workers being tortured or persecuted by Russian soldiers. There's a real question on the workforce's capacity to maintain that nuclear power plant safely and effectively in this very, very difficult circumstances. So you got two problems. One is fighting in and around the plant could damage the containment facility, causing some kind of a nuclear catastrophe, not unlike Chernobyl. Or you could have a nuclear accident just based on the workforce's either unwillingness, inability, or disappearance to actually operate this particular facility in a safe fashion. The International Atomic Energy Agency, based in Vienna, has been very outspoken in the last week or so, saying this is moving towards a nuclear catastrophe unless the Russians and the Ukrainians are able to come to some kind of agreement in the midst of this conflict to ensure that doesn't happen.
And now for something completely different, Jeff. I know you hate to get involved in domestic politics, but we have a combination of things going on here. I'm reading, admittedly on Twitter, that the whatever you want to call it, the forcible taking of Donald Trump's records pretty much guarantees that he'll run. And number two, another book coming out showing that America's top military generals pretty much did all they could to put guardrails around the president's orders, which is a nice way of saying they declined to follow them, which tells me that if Trump runs and does get elected, he won't make that same mistake again. He will be very careful to appoint military people who will follow his orders without being questioned. So tell me, do military people like that exist? And is this something that you think about?
It's something I worry about, to tell you the truth. And several really good friends of mine who are retired 3- and 4-star generals actually wrote an editorial a few weeks ago as the January 6th hearings were being conducted, pointing out that, in their opinion, Mr. Trump had abrogated his responsibilities as commander-in-chief and was derelict in his duty for just not acting promptly when the Capitol was threatened. But now we've seen, you know, in some books that have come out, one very recently, where Mr. Trump supposedly asked an egg why his generals couldn't be more like Hitler's generals and be totally loyal to him. And he's particularly supposed quizzed retired General John Kelly, his chief of staff, about that. And there's further information coming out that the current chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Mark Milley, once drafted a resignation letter accusing Mr. Trump of embracing tyranny, dictatorship, and extremism that the military had sworn to fight. Now, sad to say, I can tell you that in my experience, active and retired, I have seen senior military officers, and a number of them have come out very publicly, and we witnessed this during the campaign, endorsing Mr. Trump. So could he find people that might want to operate in the fashion that he seems to be desiring, like the German general staff who follow orders blindly? Sadly, I think that's a possibility. And it's really a concern to me because what occurred in those years was, I think, one of the greatest threats to civil-military relations in the history of our democracy. And I furthermore believe, as a professional military officer at civil-military relations, that belief that the military is subservient to democratically elected civil authority is one of the true bedrocks of the democracy. And trying to interfere like with that by politicizing the military and picking political generals, we have seen in other countries around the world to be disastrous. Hasn't happened in the United States, doesn't mean we're immune to that.
Retired Army Colonel Jeff McCausland. Jeff, thank you.
My pleasure.
Choke Points, brought to you by Acton's Quality Roofing. Drivers, you are about to be calmed. The Transportation Department will be putting in a roundabout on Highway 9 in Snohomish County. It's going to take about a week, and Chris is here with all the details.
And while putting in roundabouts on Highway 9 isn't really something new, that's the Washington Department of Transportation has been doing that a lot there on Highway 9 to kind of manage flow and manage people doing cross traffic and turning and things like that. But the latest location is kind of interesting because of the speeds that are driven there and the left-hand turns there in front of the cross traffic. This roundabout's going in where Highway 9 meets Bickford Avenue and Avenue D right there in Snohomish. I drive the spot a lot. Cars routinely going 60 miles an hour or more. There's kind of a blind curve coming down the hill, so you can't really tell if someone's coming at you or not when it's light. And, you know, drivers are making left, so they're, you know, trying to get off to the right as well. And during heavy congestion, you can't really even get on to Highway 9 there at times coming off of Bickford or Avenue D. WashDOT's Tony Black says the roundabout was really the best way to get after it.
It's mostly to kind of improve traffic flow in the area. So it's more of just kind of being able to let traffic get by, because it's really hard for cars that are trying to get onto SR9 from Bickford or Avenue D to be able to safely make those turns left or right, whichever way they were going. There is some safety elements into it as well, too. But roundabouts are a good way to be able to kind of help improve traffic flow through a rapidly growing area.
I talked to a couple of drivers in the area last week about this, and as you might expect, roundabout support is somewhat mixed.
I think the roundabouts are good. I think it keeps traffic flowing, and I think it'll be a good thing.
And they're putting a roundabout up here by Costco, too.
Yep.
So, I mean, Highway 9 is going to be nothing but stop and go anyway.
To build this roundabout, WashDOT is going to close Highway 9 for about a week. The closure begins August 16th.
The closure points are on SR9 between 2nd Street and 30th Street. So it's a pretty wide closure area, but we're working specifically in the intersection of SR9 and Bickford Avenue / Avenue D.
Black says southbound drivers will get a little bit of a break during the middle of the closure. On Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday of next week, southbound lanes will actually be open for part of the day.
Northbound SR9 will be closed the entire time. But for southbound travelers, in between basically the morning hour, so in between like 5 a.m. and 8 p.m., you will be able to use SR9 to get down there. But we really do encourage all drivers to take one of the two detours if they would like to get around, just to minimize some of the traffic impacts.
There are two defined detours. If you're traveling through, like you don't need to get to Snohomish itself, you're asked to take Highway 2 to get around, exiting at 88th and taking 2nd Street through the city. That's the southbound detour. Of course, the northbound just the opposite. For those needing to get into Snohomish, you're asked to use Bickford Avenue and Avenue D, accessing the north end at 30th, using Airport Way on the south end. If that confused all of you and I said it too fast, there are drawings at mynorthwest.com for reference about the detours to deal with.
We don't want to send all of the cars through all the local neighborhoods or anything like that. We want to say if you're trying to get around, it's much easier to just take US-2, maybe an extra 5 minutes on your trip or so.
Now, I expect this roundabout to take a little time to get used to, especially for those drivers who hit the 60-plus on that stretch of Highway 9. Roundabout should be open on August 22nd before the morning commute. And do not forget the number one rule of roundabouts.
And always remember that the people who are already in the roundabout, they are the ones who have the right of way.
Is this the first roundabout put in an arterial that's had that kind of speeds?
No, because they've done this in different sections of Highway 9, but in a lot of the places where they put them in, it's kind of on a straightaway. Here, where Avenue D and Bickford are, it's kind of a winding, almost S-curve, not quite, so there's some blind areas. I know when I'm heading northbound, it scares me sometimes to take a left to get to Bickford, because you can't quite see if someone's going to be barreling around the corner in front of you at 60. It can be a little hairy, so it'll be a transition. I think, for people to kind of get used to that, because we all know, I mean, heck, I drove a roundabout yesterday up in the Marysville area. It was a double, and of course the person was in the inside lane, needed to get off, cut right over in front of me, and right. I'm like, dude, come on, you needed to be in the other lane, come on, this shouldn't be too difficult to figure out.
The other big transportation story is the 787. What's the news there?
Yeah, it's been almost a year and a half since Boeing delivered a Dreamliner, the company, of course, dealing with the manufacturing and production problems at its South Carolina plant. The FAA yesterday gave the company a much-needed boost, saying it's comfortable enough with the changes and improvements the company has made to allow deliveries of that airplane again. American Airlines could get the first of its delayed 787 tomorrow. 120 Dreamliners are just sitting parked and awaiting delivery right now as they were working their way through these production issues. Each one of them, of course, will have to be inspected by the FAA before they will allow the delivery. To kind of reset how Boeing got here, the company found production issues in late 2019. Biggest, of course, were the small gaps between fuselage panels and the carbon fiber skin. They weren't quite joining up properly. There were also issues with unapproved titanium parts that they were using coming over from Italy. This all happened, of course, while Boeing was dealing with the aftermath of the two deadly MAX crashes and the scrutiny on safety and oversight, and the FAA was not going to be playing around anymore, and so they kind of went heavy, as probably they should have, on the 87. And while this is a big psychological boost for Boeing, of course, getting these back to being delivered, it'll likely be a huge boost for the bottom line. It could see $17 billion in cash from the delivery of these 120 Dreamliners that have been waiting for delivery. And as you know, over the last couple of years, Boeing has been bleeding cash, and so this will really help the bottom line.
Yeah. Although it's down just a fraction this morning. I mean, not by much, but it's selling at 165. Once upon a time, it was like over 200.
Oh, yeah. There were times, I mean, a lot of people, you know, granted, all points to it. My wife works for the Boeing company in the defense side, but a lot of people are looking at this and going, maybe now's the time as an investor, maybe. But again, I'm not a financial analyst. I know we're looking at it and it's like, seems like a good idea.
Politics. A potential upset in the 3rd Congressional District as incumbent Jamie Herrera-Butler loses ground in the primary voting. Let's go to Cairo News Radio's Hannah Scott with the latest. Hannah.
Yes, good morning, Dave. So we're talking about the 3rd Congressional District. This is Jamie Herrera-Butler, the Republican who's been the incumbent there for several years. She had a tough race on her hand. Big issue for her and Dan Newhouse over in the 4th District was that they had both voted to impeach President Trump after the January 6th attacks. And they were expected to face some backlash. Dan Newhouse in the 4th, he successfully made it through his primary night election, and we'll move on to November. Jamie Herrera-Butler had been in the lead, but it was very tight between her and former Green Beret and Trump-backed candidate Joe Kent. Joe Kent had been behind as leech as much as about 300 votes until last night's numbers when he pulled ahead by about 1,000 votes. On primary night, Kent was down significantly, but he and his supporters knew there were many votes left to count.
I'm still very optimistic. We have a clear pathway to victory. There's still 42% outstanding. So really, this is kind of like probably the shortest speech I'll ever do. All I'm going to say tonight is thank you. We're still very much in the fight. Let's just keep our powder dry and see what happens. We still have a pathway to victory. So we'll just keep doing what we've been doing for the past 18 months, and that's staying focused on getting Jamie Herrera-Butler out of office. So thank you guys.
In a 3rd Congressional District, voters tell Cairo 7 TV Herrera-Butler's vote to impeach did hurt her.
He's a ball of fire as far as I'm concerned, and we share a lot of the same values. Jamie would be fine. We're not anti-Jamie at all. She's done some good things, but I think it was damaging the position she took.
I thought she should have stuck with her party, and she didn't, and that was disappointment.
And as far as Kent's appeal?
Like that he's a veteran, and he's kind of stands for the working class, and he's kind of just your average guy, and that's what I'm looking for.
Now, CoinTV asked Herrera-Butler recently what losing this race would mean for her.
Southwest Washington is our home, so irrespective of what happens, I'm going to continue to serve folks here in whatever capacity they seem to think is fit.
Now, the Democrat, by the way, who is leading that by far in that race right now is Maria Glusenkamp Perez. She issued a statement after last night's numbers came out saying it appears that a white nationalist and extremist Joe Kent has pulled ahead and will be our opponent in November. That means that our race in November is going to be a national bellwether for the direction of the country and for the future of our democracy. CoinTV also recently asked Kent about those alleged connections to extremist groups like the Proud Boys.
But it's absolute garbage. I don't have any ties to any racist organizations, anti-Semitic organizations, or that trash.
So we'll see. Nobody's conceded in this race yet, but a very, very, very tight and looking more positive for Joe Kent. It looks like he's making up the ground on the back end here.
Where does he stand on the legitimacy of the 2020 election?
He has echoed what our former president has said, is that it is not legitimate.
So he says it was stolen. Where does he stand on Lauren Culp?
I believe they were out there campaigning together. I think they are their
so
buddies.
So he agrees with Lauren Culp.
Yes.
That election was stolen, too.
Yes, absolutely. But, yeah, they were both recently on one of the podcasts, Steve Bannon's podcast, I think, talking about it.
Now, I know in some areas of the country, Republican challengers actually got help from Democratic campaign money in hopes that they would, in fact, win and present an easier target for the Democrat in the race. Did that happen in this race?
That I don't know if that happened in this race. I know there was quite a bit thrown in behind Joe Kent. I think there is concern. There's a belief that moving forward, that could happen with the Democrat and Joe Kent should he become the candidate. So we'll see. This either way, this race is expected, if Jamie Herrera Butler loses, to have some significant money dumped into it.
Yeah. Now you're a savvy political observer. Do you think that the moderate Republicans who would have voted for Jamie Herrera Butler will switch their votes to the Democrat, or would they rather go with a Republican regardless of how allegedly extreme he might be?
I think that I think that Joe Kent will get that Republican vote for the most part. I think he's got a lot of appeal as a veteran. I think that when you have Marie Glusenkamp-Perez coming out with things like he's an extremist, he's this, he's a white nationalist, there are people who are really turned off by that language, and I think that could hurt her. So we'll see. That's my guess, but it's
so this is not a slam dunk for the Democrat. He's competitive.
No, I wouldn't say so. No, not at all, because here's the numbers from primary, right? So Maria Glusenkamp-Perez, sure, she's got the significant lead by far right now at 30% of the vote. So it's like 65,000 votes. Mm-hmm. Jamie Herrera Butler and Joe Kent, though, combined have more than that, over 90,000 votes together. So that's the Republican vote.
Yeah, but you're saying the people who voted for Jamie Herrera Butler, who was a Trump opponent,
right,
would then be willing to switch their votes to a Trump supporter?
Yes,
to a Democrat.
Yeah, I do think so.
Okay. Hannah Scott, thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
What a world we live in where a former president can be raided and there's jokes, too. The Daily Dose of Kindness, sponsored by Heritage Homecraft. It's a lady who loves language and all the strange rules that come along with writing it out. CBS's Steve Hartman tells her story.
Do you have any grammar questions?
Who sees grammar as such an imperative that she sets up a table just to talk about it?
Because I love grammar so much, and also
you couldn't think of anything more interesting.
But it's the anchor. Like right now, we're using words. This wouldn't even be happening. We'd just be looking at each other.
Ellen began setting up her grammar table around New York City, where she lives. And it went so well, she took the table to the collective noun that is America. We caught up with her here in New Hope, Pennsylvania, where Ellen reminded people how to diagram sentences.
I bet you remember this.
Explained when to use who and whom.
Whom? And do you know why?
And even answered something I've always wondered about. Does the period have to go inside the quotation mark? Or can it go outside in certain circumstances?
It always goes inside.
Since we first told this story, Ellen has taken her table across the country and even written a book about the experience called Rebel with a Clause. Ellen says Americans are way more interested in grammar than some cynical reporters would have you believe. And she may be right.
Yes!
I mean, this guy at a red light just had to know. Do you always capitalize after a colon?
If it's only a piece of a sentence, definitely no cap.
Okay.
Yeah.
That made her day.
Bye.
One more proper usage in Ellen's never-ending quest to make us all gooder at wording stuff.
Thank you for stopping by.
Steve Hartman on the road in New Hope, Pennsylvania.
Oh, so joyful.
I'm glad that quote thing has finally been settled.
Yeah, I know. I
struggle with that every morning.
Same.
Yeah. 7:49. And now, visiting us from the Gian Ursula Show, here he is, G. Scott.
Hey, I know you got to talk to me about something else, but I just want to take this time to just say, Dave, you look really good today.
Thank you very much.
I mean, you look absolutely fantastic.
Thank you.
Colleen, did you see him?
At 6 o'clock, the start of the show, I said, you look sharp as a tack, sir.
So what happened? Did you get a haircut?
I did get a haircut, yes.
A beard cut, too.
Do you feel better?
I feel about the same, but with less hair.
What do you mean you feel the same?
You can't inflate this man's ego. I hope you know that. I've spent 8 years trying to turn him into a radio god, and he refuses.
Look. Guys. Every so often, the hair gets so long that I find myself using a hairbrush, trying to keep it behind my ears. Mm-hmm. At that point, I say, there's too much hair here.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go to a haircut place and tell them to cut it off. And she says, do you want it a number six, number two? I said, I don't know what you're talking about. Just make it easy to comb.
Yeah.
And she does.
But Dave, when you get out of the chair, like, yeah, do you feel good? Do you look at yourself and be like, yeah? Because I know Sully, I talked to you, happy birthday to Sully yesterday.
Yeah.
He looked and felt good. He said, oh, gee, I felt good. Did you not feel good?
Gee, every time I get out of the chair these days, I look at the mirror. They hold the one up in back of you to see the back.
Yeah.
And I realize I'm still just as bald as before. So it doesn't really make a big difference.
Oh. Speaking anyway. Of losing hair, let's talk about old presidents. Yes. How'd you like that transition?
Yes, that's very good. Great. Go ahead. Run
Thank
with
you.
It.
That
Thank
was
you.
Good, Colleen.
Yeah, you wanted to talk about how old is too old to be president, because if Biden runs again, he'll be well into his, what, late 80s by the yes. time he's done?
I don't want this discussion to lead into ageism, because I just think that's disrespectful. But at the same time, I think that we, the people, would love to see President Joe Biden live out his days relaxing. And this is an opportunity for him to go out on top, especially the last month and a half that has happened. That has been some good stuff that is happening. He can cement his legacy by that. What he does not want to do is be the person that tries to be the president of the United States again, and then by the time he's done, be well into his late 80s like you're talking about. That's not the way to live out your days. Come on, President Joe Biden. This is a time to empower and actually make that announcement now.
Well,
empower
I don't know,
someone.
Because you have to wait until Trump makes his announcement, because what other Democrat can take on Trump?
Well, It should have been the Vice President of the United States, Kamala Harris.
I don't know if she could beat him.
Well, they have not. I don't think she can either.
Yeah.
But I'll agree with that.
Yeah.
But they also should have been highlighting her early. Like, it seems like she doesn't get the chance to talk. They don't put her in front on anything.
Or
so,
they're
no,
trying
I don't,
to keep her out of the controversy so she stays clean.
Well, look
so
what she did, though, in the Democratic primary, though.
Yeah.
She pulled, what, 5%?
Not great.
Among Democrats?
Yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, I'm not sure if that's where the party wants to go either.
I don't think the party wants to go that way. And like I said, it should be. Okay. And I agree, she could not beat Donald Trump. But the Donald Trump, that's another situation.
Who do you
in
think
itself.
Could? Anybody?
Mayor.
Are you going to say Mayor Buttigieg?
Mm-hmm. Who are the high-profile Democrats these days?
The one guy who's been able to hold his own in a discussion on Fox was Mayor Pete. But yeah. Then that's another social issue, right?
Not enough experience.
Well, and also gay.
Oh, right. Yeah. Are American voters comfortable? We raised the same question with women. Are they comfortable voting for a woman for president? Which is so insane. We have to ask these questions. But also, yeah, a gay man.
One thing I've learned that people say and do on social media is way different when they got that envelope in front of them and they circle right there and circle and highlight who you want to vote for. So,
what I find is when people get an envelope in front of them, 60% of them throw it away.
Yeah.
So, oh, yeah. Then that's that, too.
Is that?
So, yeah. We'll see. That question you just asked, Dave, that kind of hurt a little bit. You ask, who is it that in the Democratic Party that I do believe that can win? And I think right now that is the answer. Colleen, I think it's your answer.
Mayor Pete.
Yeah. I think that is the one answer. I don't think there's anybody else right now that is leading, but this is an opportunity right now for President Biden to help empower whoever that next person is going to be.
Right.
G. Scott, 9 o'clock, Kyra News Radio. Thank you, G. And on Tuesdays, we go live to Washington, D.C., a New York Times investigative reporter, David Farenthold. David, it's been a pretty busy 24 hours. The search warrant served on Trump's Mar-a-Lago estate. He claims basically that this is a government-run amok. His supporters are, as I mentioned, openly talking about civil war on Twitter already. If he wanted to, he'd be free to reveal the contents, the details of the search warrant, right? So people could decide for themselves whether, in fact, this was unnecessary or not, couldn't he?
Yes. So what happens is when the FBI raid your house, they leave behind the warrant that they got. And so that's different than the warrant application. So they're not going to show you all the details they showed the judge. you know, how they convince the judge that a crime had been committed, and then they might find evidence of that crime at your property. But they'd at least say what they were looking for and what statutes were broken, what laws they think were broken.
Yeah.
And so, if Trump wanted to reveal that, he certainly could. And then we'd get a better sense of what exactly they were looking for and what this investigation is about. The Times has reported, my colleagues have reported, that it's about Trump's apparent removal of classified documents from the White House to Mar-a-Lago, but we haven't seen the warrant that says so.
My understanding is, though, this is not – there's sort of the implication this is a desperate fishing expedition, but my understanding is that he's already turned over a lot of stuff to the archives, and as the archivists go through this, they see, like, missing pages or actual documentation that certain of these papers were removed, right?
So, yes, he has given the archives, I think, all of the documents that he took with him that he wasn't supposed to have taken. Federal agents have already visited Mar-a-Lago in the spring, not as a raid, but I think just to sort of ask questions about what was taken. So if this is about those documents, I think what you have to presume is that, you know, somebody went to a federal judge and convinced them that there was evidence of a crime at Mar-a-Lago. So if those classified documents – if it's about classified documents – you'd think that would have to mean that there was something else that he didn't give back or that he still had. But that's a couple of ifs. We don't know for sure that's what it's about. And we certainly don't know what they were looking for.
We also have a new book about which includes this scene described by General Mark Milley, who was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff during the Trump administration and who wrote a letter of resignation basically saying, Mr. President, you're undermining democracy. And then decided not to give it to him, but to stay on again because he felt he needed to be there to prevent civil war. So, first of all, are these revelations new and shocking to the to old hands in Washington? Does this change anybody's opinion? And what's been the reaction to it?
Well, I mean, they are new. I mean, I think they are shocking to even after so many different books have come out, you know, by first person books and third person books saying, you know, you won't believe this crazy stuff that Donald Trump said while he was president. I mean, that if Milley, the top general, you know, top military official in the U.S., felt like democracy was under threat and that he should have to resign rather than do some of the things he was being asked to do, that's very scary. And I think that, you know, what Milley said he did was he stayed inside the government and tried to sort of work from the inside, which, I mean, you can see the goal there is laudable. But it is kind of a crazy idea, and this is not the first time we've seen it, that there are basically people underneath Trump in the hierarchy, in the military and other things, saying like, well, the president's going to give an order, but we're not going to do what he said.
Right.
Even if that was the right goal, if that saved us from some calamity in the Trump era, it's kind of a dangerous precedent to set.
It is a dangerous precedent to set. All right. So, I mean, to me, what's important about this is that Donald Trump, even with all these things that have been revealed, has a huge number of dedicated supporters. We saw that at CPAC. He won the straw poll at CPAC. Second was Ron DeSantis, who is, you know, sort of what Trump light. So there is an appeal to his approach of poking a stick in the eyes of the elite. So where does this lead?
I wish I knew. I've seen, you know, commentary on both sides saying this is a bad thing for Trump because it must mean that the government has some, you know, hidden evidence we don't know about on him. And I've seen some other analysis saying this is great for Trump because it allows him to play the victim. I mean, I think you have to think back to 2016 and remember who Trump ran as. He didn't run as like, I am, you know, going to transform the country and, you know, be the Viktor Orban of America. He ran as like, I'm a, you know, I take ideas from both sides. I'm a businessman who gets things done. You know, I'm not part of the elites from either side. He didn't run as a hard right figure, even though that's what he became. So I think it's hard to evaluate, you know, for 2016 is the only sort of evidence we have of what it would be like. But I don't think there's a great parallel because Trump is a much different figure, both in what he says and the way he's perceived than he was back then. And he doesn't get the same benefit of the doubt from people that he did in 2016.
Well, no, but the thing is, I mean, he's a showman. And he's a performer, and performers are the creations of their audience. And he may have started off running as, this everyman billionaire who just wanted to take ideas for anyone. But he has now morphed into a creature of CPAC, essentially. He's now sort of he's signed on to this whole Christian nationalist thing. Right.
Right.
With, you know, he debuted that with the Bible in front of the church during that demonstration. And now it is it's all about going after wokeism. And a lot of people want that, don't they?
There are. I mean, I think Ron DeSantis' success is also a sign. He's also done that. You know, the question is not whether he could win a Republican primary. I think Trump certainly could if it was held today. The question is, you know, can you win over regular people, people who are not, you know, Trump won a lot of independents. A lot of people who voted for Obama voted for Trump. People thought of themselves as not really that political, but they just wanted a guy to fix the problem, a guy who wasn't corrupt like Hillary, blah, blah, blah. You know, would you get the same voters in a general election now? Maybe. The interesting thing to me is that this is a year set up for Republicans to win. They have so many advantages. There's, you know, always a backlash against presidents during a midterm. There's inflation, you know, concerns about recession. And this is what they're talking about. Donald Trump, the raid on Donald Trump's house, wokeism. They're not putting forward an economic plan that would appeal to people who just want the economy to be better. And so I think even in 2022, we're seeing in what could be a great year for Republicans, the downside of taking Trump's grievances as their guiding light.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we'll see what happens in the midterms, but I'm looking at 2024 now. We have, Maureen Dowd urging Biden not to run in the New York Times. David Brooks urging Biden not to run. You know, Brooks is a Republican, but a moderate, urging Biden not to run because he's too old. Who runs then?
Yes,
who's this normal person who's going to be on the ballot in 2024?
I have no idea. I mean, in the polling, to the degree that anybody is standing out of the pack, it's like Pete Buttigieg, the transportation secretary. But, you know, that's a guy who has not won any office higher than the mayor of South Bend, Indiana. So I don't know. There's a lot of speculation about people like Raphael Warnock or other people who are not seen as presidential contenders now. It's still a long way away from 2024. And if Biden decides not to run, or, you know, there's a lot of Democrats who'd like to step into that void. We couldn't even – like the environment for the midterms for this year has changed so much in the last month. Yeah. I think it's so hard to predict what's going to happen in 2024 from now.
David Farenthold. My advice to Biden, though, is just would you please get all your throat clearing done before they open the mics? That would be my advice. Thank you, David.
Thank you.
I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News.
You can hear us live every morning on 97.3 FM or subscribe to this podcast and you'll never miss the show.